This week on Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
You know, what could happen? You could get on the stage, you put all three of them there, but Trump looks like he's with it. RFK looks like he's with it. And Biden looks like he's, you know, waiting for the tapioca.
Attention passengers. We ask that you please fasten your seatbelts at this time and secure all baggage underneath your seat or in the overhead compartments. Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is prepared for takeoff.
A very busy week in flyover country with Scott Jennings going viral, his CNN clip being shown on Fox News of all places, a big readout of the president's call with Benjamin Netanyahu, and some new polling out that is causing lots of consternation on all across the political spectrum. I am your roundtable host, Joe Arnold. Jared Crawford is behind the dials, and Scott Jennings is joining us. Hello, Scott.
Brother Joe, you know, this is a great day. We're recording on April the 4th. And for you and me, this is an amazing holiday. Opening day at Busch Stadium in St. Louis. As soon as we complete this recording, I'm sure you and I both will be flipping on the St. Louis Cardinals today. And so welcome back to baseball in St. Louis. Great day.
In St. Louis, Missouri, we're at Busch Memorial. Actually, it's called Busch Stadium. It used to be Busch Memorial, but named after the beer company, yeah. Of course. And it's the only city where as I was growing up as a grade schooler, you learned the words to the Busch beer song. Here comes the king, and he is a number one. When you say Bud, you have like 11-year-olds who are singing this song. Am I right?
Oh, one of my favorite things at Busch Stadium is when they play that song in the eighth inning. You know, they play Take Me Out to the Ball Game in the seventh, but then we get Here Comes the King. So, great song, great tradition. That's great, and we've had spring break going on, although it was not a great spring break for the people of Prospect, Kentucky, where I live, because of a huge tornado that ripped through the area. So that was unfortunate. In the neighborhood that got hit, I used to live in that neighborhood and certainly recognize some of those houses. So hope those folks get back on their feet sooner rather than later.
We are thinking about everyone who was affected. I think there are up to more than 10, 11 tornadoes that have been confirmed that actually struck. It crossed the Ohio River, Scott, not too far from where I am, I live, but it was crazy because it's, you know, I'm watching the radar, I'm watching everything, and I know where it's coming across, and it's like maybe a mile or two from me, but in my backyard where I'm looking out the back window, very little wind, and I don't know if tornadoes kind of suck up the energy or something, and as a result, we were very unscathed. I mean, throughout the whole thing, but a mile or two away was terrible.
Yeah, we didn't fortunately have any problems in our neighborhood either, but we were very close to the where it touched down, and so we're lucky, and we thank God for being spared on that, and we are hoping for cleanup efforts to accelerate for the people who got hit. I think only one person died in the tornadoes this time around, which was great. Compared to what happened to Kentucky the last time we had the big tornadoes, which of course was very devastating. So severe weather, got to track it and pay attention to it for sure.
It happened, by the way, on the day before the 50th anniversary of the supercell outbreak in 1974 that devastated much of Kentucky, Brandenburg, especially Louisville, a lot of populated areas. I bring this up, Scott, this is a quick suggestion. If I haven't given this before on the podcast, then we'll get to the breaking news of the day. And that is, there is a show on the Smithsonian Channel called The Lost Tapes. And I've watched a bunch of these. I think the entire series of these, but includes one of a great kind of retrospective on what happened on that day in April 3rd of 1974. And of course, turmoil across the world, specifically, certainly the bloodshed and the conflict continuing in Israel. Scott, you had a phone call today between President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister.
Yeah, this was in the wake of the bombing where Israeli forces hit the World Kitchen vehicles, these aid trucks, and I think seven people died. Israel, I have to say, fully transparent, owned it, launched an investigation, complete honesty and transparency right out of the gate here. I think they're doing what they need to do. I think some of the things that have been said about Israel in the wake of this are wholly unsubstantiated and completely vile, frankly. And it's coming from the people that, you know, want Israel to stop defending itself in the first place. I mean, it is terrible what happened. This is a war zone, and things do happen. This should not have happened. I mean, I'm just going to quote what the IDF said. This should not have happened. But at the same time, what also should not happen is for people to forget why this war is going on in the first place. Because Hamas killed 1,200 people. These terrorists took hostages, still have hostages. Americans are still there. That's why this war is going on in the first place. Yesterday, Hamas rejected another ceasefire offer. And so this whole World Kitchen debacle has set off, obviously, a round of outrage in Washington, D.C. This led Joe Biden to call Benjamin Netanyahu and speak to him sternly. And I guess, first of all, Jared, let's hear from John Kirby, who's the president's national security spokesperson. He's the person they put at the podium when something serious is happening, so Karine Jean-Pierre won't mess it up. But let's hear from John Kirby, who is describing the nature of the president's call to Netanyahu.
Their policy decisions.
And you're not talking about what potential U.S. policy changes are on the table. Can you say whether the president shared that with the prime minister on this phone call?
The president made clear that that absent changes in the protection of civilians on the ground, absent changes to the volume of humanitarian assistance getting in, absent any movement on a ceasefire that will allow hostages to get out and more aid to get in, absent, you know, a calming down, that he will have to reconsider his own policy choices with respect to Gaza.
And one.
So, you know, look, what the problem to me, Joe, with Biden's position on all this is, everyone, including Biden, is always talking about what is Israel's responsibility. Israel has to do this. Israel has to do that. Israel has to do this. Does anyone ever say, what should Hamas do? Has he ever called Hamas and say, hey, you should do a better job of not raping and torturing people. Hey, you should do a better job of not taking hostages. Hey, maybe you should stop using people as human shields. The entire responsibility for this is put on Israel. And no one seems to be holding Hamas accountable for what they're doing. And to me, it's just outrageous.
And to your point about human shields, that is the point of all of this, is that for people who are innocent victims in Palestine, the people in Gaza Strip or anywhere else, that the number one thing you can do is overturn Hamas, is not,
yes,
is reject the terrorist leadership that has caused this in the first place. You know, we've seen other situations where, you know, the complaints have been that Israel is bombing hospitals. But then later on, as you go in and you take a look at what was there, this was Hamas using the hospitals in a very, you know, cynical way, you know, to as human shields again, to be able to launch their terrorist attacks. So, in fact, one of the early reporting on the World Central Kitchen situation was, there was intelligence that there was a Hamas person. I mean, they were going to pick up, I believe, or they just maybe dropped something off at a warehouse. That was one of their warehouses, but then they were going from there someplace else. And there was intelligence apparently at some point that Hamas was embedded there or was a part of that. So what does Israel do in that situation, Scott? I mean, I obviously have to be careful, and you can't bomb innocent people if you know that they're innocent. But at the same time, if you have intelligence, because the whole, actually, if we could, before I ask you the question, can we hear from Jose Andres and let's hear from his allegations about World Central Kitchen itself being targeted.
17 members between the specialty security people we have, 3 British individuals and three international crew plus 1 Palestinian, that they were targeted systematically, car by car. And this happened over more than 1.5, 1.8 kilometers. So this was not just bad luck situation where, oops, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place or no. This was over 1.5, 1.8 kilometers with a very defined humanitarian convoy that had signs in the top, in the roof, a very colorful logo that we are obviously very proud of, but that's very clear who we are and what we do. But what I know is that we were targeted deliberately, nonstop, until everybody was dead in this convoy.
So, Scott, this is not the first time that he's, you know, been more aggressive on that. Obviously, he's upset about what happened to his team there. What's your readout?
Well, look, I think World Central Kitchen, I think they have done some good work around the world. I think what he is saying is effectively a blood libel, which is unsupported by logic or evidence. I mean, he's saying that Israel bombed his convoy specifically to invite this massive PR, you know, crap storm on themselves. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, you have to go back in time and remember, he's been accusing Israel of all kinds of things since this war started. He's been calling for a ceasefire since October the 13th, which was a week after the terrorist attack happened. So he's also a huge liberal. He supports Democratic causes. He hates Republicans. He hates Donald Trump. I mean, he is a partisan. I think he has partisan viewpoints, and that's fine. But I don't think those should extend to accusing Israel here of something that is completely illogical and unsupported by the evidence. I'm sure he's in shock. I'm sure this is a moment of grief, and my heart goes out to these people who were killed trying to do something good. But at the same time, you cannot have irresponsible rhetoric like this. He's a central player in this story. It's important that we know what happened. But what's also important is that people don't lie about what happened. And I think what he's saying right now is just unsupported by the facts and really makes no sense, you know, from a strategic perspective for the Israelis. It's unfathomable to me that he would make that kind of comment. What do you think?
Oh, I certainly agree. And I will say the Biden administration, despite, you know, some of the stance today, is still saying it supports Israel. I will, you know, to paraphrase Kirby again, he said today that, you know, Israel is still under a viable threat of Hamas.
Yes.
And so which of course is the right thing to say. But I don't know if the folks like Jose Andres or others understand that. I mean, I guess what I'm saying, the overall approach from, and again, he's a do-gooder, and in terms of the World Central Kitchen, it's a valuable service for the innocent victims of warfare. But sometimes some folks can just be very naive in terms of just kind of be able to wash your hands and say, let's just make it all go away. Call a ceasefire. Everyone goes back to their own camps, and then we'll have peace on earth.
Well, what's lost in his comments, Biden's comments, you know, anybody? Hamas can end this war today. If they would release the hostages and give up, this war would end today. I mean, that's a fact. But they're not doing that. They keep rejecting ceasefire proposals. They rejected one yesterday, I think, on
April 3rd. You know what the grounds are? What are they holding out for?
They don't want Israel to exist. They want Israel to die. They want Jews to die. I mean, they don't want a ceasefire because war means they get to kill the enemy. I mean, I don't think a lot of these people understand that. For Hamas, this is their dream, you know, to murder Jews and to take hostages and to torture people that they treat as subhumans. I mean, this is their dream. And Israel is being treated here by a lot of folks in Washington, D.C., like somehow they're the bad guy. I'm stunned at the people in Washington right now who appear to be unable to tell the difference between who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. The bad guys are the murderers. The bad guys are the rapists. The bad guys are the torturers. The bad guys are the hostage takers. Those are the bad guys. You mentioned the hospital thing. You know, these guys go into hospitals. They put hundreds of terrorists in a hospital. That was the big story before this World Kitchen thing happened, was that Israel had gone in and cleared out this hospital complex and destroyed it. It was a base for the enemy. It was a base for Hamas. And Israel evacuated every single person. There wasn't a single civilian death. They took care of everything in that hospital. And no one seemed to care. No one seemed to care. That's what is crazy about this. Israel, I think, is doing its level best to meet these standards that Joe Biden is laying out. But when they meet them, it's just sort of greeted with this, oh, well, great. Okay, oh, well, you knocked down our hospital. I guess we won't have that anymore. It drives me crazy. I mean, Israel is responsible for everything here, even though they're the aggrieved party.
Well, and to your point, Hamas has succeeded to a degree in the sense that they have turned the world opinion, some of the world's opinion at least, against Israel. And going into the situation, of course, Hamas, long before this happened, was already designated a terrorist group by the civilized world. And here, how is it that they're, A, going into this a terrorist group, they carry out a terrorist attack, and as a result, people are no longer considering them a terrorist group?
Well, look, I think it has less to do with Hamas and more to do with the fundamental truth. There are a whole bunch of people in this world who hate the Jews, okay? I mean, let's just be honest. Anti-Semitism is obviously on the rise, and this war has given a whole bunch of people the idea that it's now okay to say it out loud. And some of them are in America. A lot of them are in America. They're around the world. But this has exposed, I think, an awful truth about our world and our society. Anti-Semitism is real. Hatred for the Jews, the Jewish people, the state of Israel is real. And you get into a war with a terrorist organization and you're siding with the terrorists? I mean, that's a hatred that runs pretty deep, and it's pretty appalling. And I hate it to see some of these Washington politicians fall into this trap. And but it is revealing about character and about who people are. You know, for Biden, a lot of this, though, is just political. Like, he's not worried about this, I don't think, geopolitically. He's worried about it electorally. And he's, you know, I heard somebody said the other day, he's got a two-state solution, Michigan and Nevada. and you know, people keep talking about Michigan because you have this huge Arab American population there. And so I think, and then, you know, you look at the national polling and he's suffering among these younger voters who I guess have sided with Hamas on this thing. And so I think he's as much worried about that as anything. But in the meantime, what comes of these American hostages? What comes of these Americans who were murdered? I mean, their memories, I guess, are just left behind in the great chase for 270 electoral votes.
I appreciate the yellow ribbon I saw you sporting on CNN, and I'm hopeful that people don't forget. I was at a temple, a synagogue here in Louisville about a week ago, and walked in and was struck by, across the front of the synagogue, they have the photographs of the American hostages who are, and others as well, other Israelis that are not all of them, but maybe 15 photographs across, and there were empty chairs with the photographs propped up on there. And so every time they attend service there, they see the faces of the people who are still there. The problem is, Scott, is that that's in a Jewish temple, but how, where else are we seeing the faces, and how else are we remembering these people who have been there since October, and who's to say if they're alive or dead?
Well, in a lot of cities, we were seeing them on posters that had been put up, you know, to keep their memory alive. And of course, what did we see? A bunch of broken-brained idiots running around tearing down their posters. I mean, you must really, really hate the Jews if you're going to run around tearing down the posters of people who've been taken hostage by a band of murderous, torturous thugs. I mean, you must really, really hate the Jews if you want to tear down a poster. But how many videos did we see of people running around cities all over America tearing these things down? And so I'm going to keep wearing my yellow ribbon on CNN because I just, as you hear this discourse progress week after week after week, you hear fewer and fewer people talking about the hostages, bring the hostages home. You know, when Biden tweets about this, I think the first sentence should be this, the very first thing that must happen is Hamas must release the hostages. It should be the first statement of everything they do, but yet it's often forgotten or the last sentence. And I cannot believe we're forgetting these people.
As we're speaking here again, Scott mentioned earlier, we're recording this in the 3 o'clock Eastern time hour on Thursday, April 4th. And as we speak, there are all kinds of warnings and issues or concerns in Israel and Tel Aviv of a potential attack by Iran there in retaliation for the Israeli strike on an Iranian compound in Syria that killed some military officials there. this, you know, obviously this is a, this Hamas attack in October has touched off this, the powder keg, which always is the Middle East, Scott. I mean, this is a situation where, but let's not make any mistakes where it comes from.
Yeah. Oh, you know, something I've been wanting to mention. I don't think we've talked about it on any of our previous discussions of this. John Fetterman, the senator from Pennsylvania, deserves 100% our praise for being a stalwart on this. Fetterman, look, I was critical of him during his Senate race last year. This guy's transformation into a rock-ribbed stalwart for Israel has impressed the hell out of me. I got to tell you, I mean, he's got these protesters outside of his house where he goes, people banging on him. Heck, his three communications staffers resigned. I guess they were mad. Their boss didn't hate the Jews enough. And so they went off to find other bosses that hate the Jews more. Fetterman is amazing. And he has been absolutely steadfast, even in the wake of this World Kitchen thing this week. He's been absolutely steadfast, unwavering supporter of Israel. Jared, play Mr. Fetterman.
I think everybody wants Hamas destroyed, but I think the position Netanyahu seems to be taking, and I'm wondering how you feel about him these days, is that destroy Hamas at all costs. Mm. You know, they say many of the victims now are women and children, clearly very, very innocent. I know what you're saying, no life is better than the other. We understand that. But at what point do you say we have to come up with another strategy that at least keeps the innocent, the women and the children, safe?
Well, it is very important to minimize the kind of collateral damage and protecting civilization lives as well. And I would hope that Hamas decides to not starting to hide behind civilians and creating those circumstances that makes it even more difficult as well.
But that seems to be their strategy too, Senator, to hide behind.
Yes. Yeah, that is their strategy. And now even in hospitals or in the tunnels and everything. And we also can't forget about the hostages as well, too. They've been now in custody now since October 7th. So it's an awful situation. And you don't have to agree. You don't have to agree with every leader's views. But, you know, we have an opportunity to stand with Israel in this situation. And that's what I've decided to do.
So anyway, I just thought it was worth calling out, Joe. I think most of these Democrats are running scared from their own base. And when you see somebody like John Fetterman stand up and say, no, I'm gonna be able to tell you the difference between right and wrong and who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, Republicans who support Israel, we have to take note of that and make sure people know about it.
Fetterman's saying about Netanyahu, you don't have to agree with every leader's views, but you know, we have an opportunity to stand with Israel in this situation. That's what I've decided to do. If everyone just would come together and say, I stand with Israel, and not undermine, you know, the entire our foreign policy for that matter. I mean, look, this is where the Biden administration, you know, I understand that there are political consequences to these kind of things, but ultimately, if he's more decisive and is more rock ribbed when it comes to the support for Israel, I mean, you know where we stand. And I think he would look stronger, which from an electoral matter, as we'll maybe go to polls here, Scott, as an electoral matter, Joe Biden is considered to be a weak president.
People are always talking about, his position on the war is going to hurt him with the youngsters and the Arab Americans. Does anyone ever say, well, maybe when he attacks Israel, it's hurting him with the Jewish Americans? I mean, no one ever seems to talk about the other side of the ledger here. And so, you know, Jewish Americans, they tend to vote about three quarters for Democrats. I mean, it's a big constituency of the Democratic Party. It's not insignificant at all. And no one ever seems to worry about them. It's funny. I don't know why. Gosh, real little brain teaser. But anyway.
Let's talk about weakness. Yes.
You want to talk about the polls?
Yeah.
You want to do that? Let's do it. Because,
So Wall Street Journal has signaled that this is the beginning of a series of articles and polls and to deep dives into the seven most competitive states. And right now, Donald Trump is leading President Biden in six of them.
Yeah, most of the swing state polling, whether it's this new Wall Street Journal poll or the Morning Consult stuff that we've seen and talked about,
has shown Trump leading in the most important state. So let's go through this one from the Wall Street Journal. Arizona, very close last time. Trump up 5 points, 47-42. Georgia, Trump only up one, 44-43. Michigan, Trump up three, 48-45. North Carolina, Trump up six, 49-43. Nevada, Trump up four, 48-44. Pennsylvania, Trump up three, 47-44, and tied in Wisconsin, 46 each. Now, taken in aggregate, a couple of numbers, Joe, jumped out to me in this survey. One is, and this is a unique election because voters can actually compare the job approval of the recent, of the most recent president to the current president because they're running against each other. It's highly unusual, of course. So in this sample of these seven states, Donald Trump had a 51% approval rating, a job approval. I asked him, how do you think he did as president? 51%. Joe Biden would kill for numbers like that. Joe Biden, on the other hand, only has a 38% approval rating. That's a huge gulf between them. And then number two, this sample in aggregate, only 28% of voters thought Joe Biden was mentally sharp enough to serve a second term. So you've got Trump with some small leads in these swing states and a big lead on job approval and still lingering concerns about Joe Biden's ability to do the job.
So if the election were held today, certainly it would not look very promising for Joe Biden, according to these polls and in the states that will likely decide the election. My question for you, though, Scott, as a veteran of these campaigns, is that, I mean, my memory of what I learned about polling over the years is that it's less about a number on a specific day than it is about the movement of the numbers when you have a baseline, when you show like where things have were and where they're going. What do we know about that? And what are you seeing here that indicates what both campaigns have to do?
Well, number one, Biden has to get a better job approval. I mean, it's just it strikes me as fundamentally difficult to get reelected president if only 38% of the American people think you're doing a good job. You could probably get elected in the mid 40s. Certainly Obama did, I think. But boy, being below 40 and expecting to get reelected is hard. And how do you get a better job approval? For Biden, it's still all about people's economic anxieties and his age. Can't really fix his age. But this persistent anger at Biden over inflationary policies and the fact that food still costs a massive amount of money, along with everything else, it is just killing him. It's killing him. And so until they get their arms around how to solve that, which I have no belief that they will, it's going to be hard for him to see an uptick in his job approval. You know, his softness, I mean, it's among working class Americans. It's among people who, you know, feel it when the grocery bill goes from $100 to $150. It's among people who, you know, don't have the luxury of, you know, being in a, you know, something of a financial bubble that's protects them from the undulations, you know, that everyday working class Americans feel. So to me, those are big problems. I still got major problems with Hispanics. He's way underwater with Hispanic voters, still softness with African-Americans. Young voters are not happy with him. So, you know, you can see where he's got work to do. For Trump, it's still the same. People in the suburbs are not liking Donald Trump that much. They are very, again, these college degrees, people with college degrees, sort of upper middle class, suburban types, they abandoned him in 2020. They abandoned the Republicans in 2022. They are not happy with Donald Trump in 2024. So that's his softness, you know. So for both parties, you have to ask yourself, can I recover these people or can I replace them with someone else? And for Trump, to me, the obvious answer is it's going to be hard to recover them, but you might be able to replace them with these working class voters who are disaffected with Joe Biden. And the transfer of those people, that's the algebra question of this election, is, you know, which is more, you know, the working class people who just want inflation to go away or the suburban voters who are flowing out of the Republicans and into the Democrats.
And it seems to me, just from a 30,000 foot view of the inflation issue, and I think you're exactly right on that note, Scott, because this is where people live. People tend to eat every week and tend to go to the grocery store and see these things. And The problem is that all of these, the major inflationary gains, if you will, on prices, those are all locked in. I mean, it's easy to say. What happens is we talked about this on a previous podcast where I talked about a presentation that I went to and an economist speaking there who was just sort of like, couldn't figure out why people are so upset. Like, you know, if they would just kind of step back, they would see how great the economy is. But I'm, you know, and but I'm looking at so since 2019, the Wall Street Journal, again, since we're quoting them earlier, prices for grocery items, for hundreds of items that they track, have increased more than 50%. So those are all locked in. Cooking oil, 54% up since 5 years ago. Beef, 51% higher. Fruit, snacks, and shapes, 77% higher. Mayonnaise for your crab sandwich, Scott, 50% higher. Applesauce, 51% higher. Those are just some examples. But the problem is, so they can go, Biden can say, oh, no, this is not true. It's inflation is actually coming down. What he means is the rate of inflation is not, you're not being gouged as much, at least the way that he would put it, at the same rate as you were, you know, 2 years ago. But all those are locked in. And even though there has been some upward wage pressure, it's still not enough in terms of your overall economic outlook of your family and your life to make up for the fact that it just costs more to live today than it did 5 years ago.
Are you saying that Joe Biden is not being honest about something? Because I find this exceedingly difficult to believe.
I have a heart. Sometimes he is so convincing in his beliefs. I do believe he is someone who can be somewhat, as you would say, magical thinking, that I think he can somehow exercise that and believe in it so much. It's just why he tells the stories the way he does with such conviction. Yes, I was there for this particular historical event that didn't happen until 5 years after I was born. You know, I was part of this, you know, this lawsuit that was actually settled by a different attorney. You know, I think, though, he is someone, because of his record and his convictions, he believes if he says it loud enough and often enough that he can kind of wish it into being.
Yeah, the most recent whopper, of course, was after the Key Bridge collapsed in Baltimore. His immediate press conference about it, he said that he really remembered taking the train over that bridge countless times. There are no train tracks on this bridge. Of course, you know what's strange? I don't know if I know another person like this who cannot resist the opportunity to insert themselves into every single thing that happens. It's so weird. Like, hey, man, sometimes you just weren't there. Like, it, you know, it's okay. A lot of us weren't there. You know, he has this, he's like presidential FOMO. Like, he can't abide by the idea that he wasn't in the middle of something. It's bizarre.
The unfortunate thing, though, Scott, is that he's facing the only other person that I can think of who has a long record of exaggeration and making things up, and that's Donald Trump.
But you know what? I'm going to defend Trump because I've never heard Donald Trump claim he, you know, was marching with Mandela and in a prison cell with Mandela. I've never heard him say he grew up in a, you know, in a Puerto Rican neighborhood in Delaware. I've never, you know, yes, I totally agree with you. He is a world-class BS artist. Got it. To me, though, that's different than this instinct to literally make up some way to insert yourself into every major world of it. It's crazy. I mean, let's just be honest. It's crazy. If any of us on this podcast did that, you'd be like, dude, are you okay? I mean, it's crazy. It's so
well. The biggest difference, though, is between Trump and Biden is the fact that Trump is called on it and Biden is not, but by the people who cover these campaigns.
Sure.
And that's the biggest difference of it all. And that's my, I mean, so I say a pox on all their houses, you know, the prevaricators and the exaggerators and the people who don't deserve our trust. You know how I feel about that. But at least the media is, you know, pays attention. The problem with the media on Trump, though, is that the belief system, it's so part of their DNA now and part of their core existence, is just to presume that everything Donald Trump says is either false or outrageous and unacceptable, that they even take the things that he's not saying and they make it into something it's not, which reminds me of your appearance on CNN this past week with Wolf Blitzer. You get along great with Wolf and Bakari Sellers and others on there. But Scott, it seemed to me in this moment, let's hear from the clip first, then we'll get Scott's reaction to himself, Jared, if we can. And that is when Wolf Blitzer, let's hear that, make sure we include the question from Wolf about the comments Donald Trump made about violent criminals who come across the border and commit crimes in the U.S.
When he says these immigrants are animals, they're not humans, what does that suggest? I mean, isn't that brutal? Shouldn't people be condemning that?
I listened to the entire tape. He was specifically talking about the person who murdered Lakin Riley in Georgia. And to be honest with you, Wolf, if somebody murders another human being, I think they deserve to be called animals. And I don't think any American is really going to reject that kind of rhetoric. That poor girl was murdered in cold blood. Is that person who did it not an animal? I think that's an apt term.
So, Scott, you make clear you listen to the entire tape and not just the selective edits where people are trying to make a political point.
Well, so what happened on this deal is Trump made these comments. And then, by the way, something that I've found amazing is the qualifications for being a Democratic communications staffer right now are just take something Donald Trump said, selectively edit it down, string it together, whatever, and then put it out as though he made a different statement than he actually made. That's what happened here. And so what the Democrats wanted to do was portray Trump as having said all immigrants are animals. That's not what happened. If you listen to the clip, which I did my homework before we went on the air, he was clearly talking about the animal that murdered Lakin Riley in Georgia. I mean, it's obvious. It's a lot like the bloodbath comment. You go back to that. Donald Trump's promising a bloodbath. Okay, did anyone listen to the clip? Well, if you did, you heard him talking about if Joe Biden wins, there'll be a bloodbath in the American auto industry because his policies are bad. It was obvious. All you have to do is listen to it. But what the Democrats do very effectively is they selectively edit and chop up these clips, and then they immediately get them onto X. And then all the TV people snatch them up and put them right on the air and say, aren't you outraged by this? Without ever really listening to what actually happened. So in this case, I just wanted to say, look, I listened to the clip. That's not what he was saying. I wasn't trying to insult anyone or be a jerk about it. And by the way, I love Wolf Blitzer. I love his show. And I think he is, you know, a legend of this business. This had nothing to do with Wolf, but to me, it just had to do with the way that clip was being laundered by the Democrats into something that it actually wasn't. Trump says a lot of things that are criticism worthy. That wasn't one of them. And my point was, if somebody murders somebody else, yeah, I think I'll call them an animal, and I don't think anybody's going to disagree with me. And so I know it's gotten around the internet a bit, and people told me the other networks were playing it, I don't know. In this election, I think you need to be on the lookout for something very, very serious. If you see a shortened or edited clip of Donald Trump, you need to not take it at face value, because there is a really high chance that if it's been circulating on your social media feed, it has most likely been edited out of a larger context to make it seem like he was saying something that he wasn't.
Two things. One, to Wolf Blitzer and CNN's credit, you're on his show. I mean,
all the time.
My point being is that, so he asked the question, Scott, he said, you know, shouldn't they condemn, or how can this be? Well, he also set you up. He gave an opportunity for you to respond and in a very undeniable way. The second thing is, though, it's what's not that I'm in the business of giving advice, any political advice to any campaign or to our party. But if I was giving any advice to Democrats, it would be Donald Trump says plenty of crazy crap that you could attack him on. I mean, you don't have to make stuff up, necessarily, you know?
No.
So, I mean, for instance, on that, and I believe in the same speech that he rightfully called the violent murderer an animal. Mm-hmm. He also said the United States would cease to exist if he's not elected president. So now Donald Trump is Mr. Hyperbole. He does things for the point of exaggeration. Most of us kind of see through that filter. I do believe that if you're a president or a presidential candidate of a major political party, there comes with that a responsibility to be presidential and not to say things like our country is going to cease to exist, even if he's joking, even if he's exaggerating. But I'm saying is I think there would be that panel would have been a lot more or that conversation would a lot more legitimate if it hadn't been based upon, you know, just selective editing.
Yeah, I agree. I think the immigration topic with Trump has always attracted the most heat, for lack of a better word. It's a wrestling term. It's always attracted the most heat for the purposes of cable debates. And, this was all in the context of his campaign launching a larger conversation about illegal immigration. I think they're calling it the Biden immigration bloodbath or whatever in middle America. So I think that was what was driving sort of the interest in it. But I just think we have to be hyper vigilant about these clips, man. It's just you cannot take these things at face value. There's a whole bunch of very, very well followed accounts on X that are dedicated to moving around things that are selectively edited, taken out of context, and so on and so forth. So, oh, by the way, yes. I know we got to take a break. I just want to say one more thing about John Fetterman. While we've been on the air, while we've been recording this, Fetterman has tweeted. This is incredible. So he tweeted a screenshot of the New York Times report, which says, in a call with Netanyahu, Biden called an airstrike that killed aid workers unacceptable and appeared to condition support on how Israel changes course. Fetterman screenshotted that, tweeted it with this comment. In this war against Hamas, no conditions for Israel. I'm just telling you, John Fetterman, that's me clapping. I'm just telling you, this guy, my hat's off. I'm about to send this guy a contribution. I mean, honestly, he is absolutely a stalwart. So once again, proving my point, this guy won't back down. I love it.
Scott mentioned that happening as we've been recording the podcast. Also, a judge in Georgia has made a decision since we've been recording this podcast this afternoon. That decision and one in New York when we come back with Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
Hey there, Flyover Country listeners. Today's episode is brought to you by the Bluegrass Media Lab, Kentucky's premier media studio. The Bluegrass Media Lab offers a wide array of services, including video production, podcasting, live shot broadcasting, web development, media training, and more. You name it, they do it. Head over to bluegrassmedialab.com today to get in touch. Now, back to more Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
You are listening to Flyover Country with Scott Jennings. Jared Crawford's microphone's not working, but he is doing a capable job of engineering this podcast from a Starbucks somewhere on the East Coast. Scott Jennings is joining us, and I'm your roundtable host too, with a very small roundtable between Scott and me talking about. But let's go back to the Donald Trump, Scott. I will say that since we've been recording here, a judge in Georgia denied Trump's attempt to use the First Amendment and an argument there because they said they have a right to protest the results of the 2020 election on First Amendment grounds. And the judge said that those protections do not reach the actions and statements that are alleged by the state of Georgia in terms of election interference. So that was that. That was comes one day after a New York judge also denied a Trump attempt to try to basically, a very broad claim of presidential immunity. So that does not work in the case that's being adjudicated there. I guess that's the Stormy Daniels case, right? Like you do the best job of anyone of keeping me on track of which case is which.
Yeah, the case in New York is the Stormy Daniels hush money case. I affectionately call it on TV the sex paperwork case. And it is going to trial. So Donald Trump will be on trial, I guess, as of April the 15th. So that's that one. The other news on trials, which has happened while we've been recording. So in the Florida documents case, Judge Eileen Cannon has rejected Trump's effort to dismiss his charges based on the Presidential Records Act. But the judge also declined Jack Smith's demand that she reveal her legal thinking on the matter, a demand she called unjust. So I guess Trump was trying to get that kicked out based on his view that the PRA, the Records Act, protects him and he can take any document he wants. She threw that out. So that was not a win for him. So, you know, where do we stand on this? It strikes me that obviously we're going to have a trial in New York. The Supreme Court sometime in early summer is going to have to rule on. And by the way, I mean, likelihood he gets convicted, pretty high. Then the Supreme Court has to rule on his arguments about presidential immunity before he can then get a trial date for his January 6th case in Washington. Still unclear to me whether that's actually going to go to trial or not. We will see. But right out of the gate here in April, we're going to see Donald Trump in a criminal trial in New York City. And he's not fared very well in New York trials, the courts lately. So it could be that by the Kentucky Derby, Donald Trump is a convicted felon in New York City.
For those folks listening from outside of Kentucky, the Kentucky Derby every year, except for COVID years and World War II, is held on the first Saturday in May. So you're talking about basically 1 month from now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, how will this affect the election? You know, I mean, I don't think Trump's hardest core supporters are going to mind it so much. I've always thought there was a cohort of people who won't vote for a convicted felon. This New York case to me is ridiculous. At the time it was indicted, you know, you had legal scholars from the left and right coming out saying this was ridiculous, shouldn't be charged, it's stupid. So I don't know. I mean, you never want to be convicted of a crime. At the same time, that this case has been so thoroughly denigrated and deconstructed by legal experts, I don't know. I mean, it just strikes me as superfluous, and it smacks of politics. It smacks of partisan politics in New York, people who want to get Donald Trump. We got to get him. We got to give him his comeuppance. And they pick this stupid thing. The far more consequential case to me is the January 6th case. The documents case, I don't think it's going to trial before the election. So, you know, whether he ever faces trial on that will depend on, in my opinion, whether he actually gets elected or not.
You mentioned what might step in the way of some traditional Republican voters from not voting for the Republican candidate for president might be this conviction. You know, I am reminded, I didn't ask you about this in advance, Scott, but did you see that Mark Esper, the former Trump defense secretary, I think was on Bill Maher's show on HBO and saying that he's not going to vote for Trump and he's not there yet, but he's considering voting for Joe Biden. I guess I bring this up in terms of this cohort of voters that you're talking about, which are the traditional conservative voters who ordinarily would never consider voting for a Joe Biden because of just everything Joe Biden stands for, everything Joe Biden has done since he's become president. It's unthinkable. But is that that? How important is that group, I guess, is my question in terms of this presidential contest?
Well, first of all, on Esper, I mean, he absolutely said, there's no way I'll vote for Trump. And that was a direct quote. Right. You know, Biden, he sounds like he's going to vote for Joe Biden. There's not another viable alternative. Esper, by the way, works with me at CNN. He's one of our contributors now. You know, I have contested that this group of people there's two groups. Let me back up. Who would be upset about Donald Trump getting convicted of a crime? I've often wondered, like, if you have older Republican voters, people who remember the before times, yeah. And it's like hard for them to fathom that the president would be a convicted felon or, you know, a convicted criminal of any kind.
Let me ask you a question. Okay, how old is old?
I don't think you want me to answer that. I'm going to be honest with you. but, you know, older voters and interestingly, they were soft on Trump in 20.
Yeah.
A lot of them went to Biden. I still think, and I think, you know, I think some of them may be with Biden now. And I don't know. I just imagine there's some older Republicans out there who don't want to do that. So I don't know. I don't know if we're talking about a handful or a bushel or what, but it's probably not massive percent, but it's a little bit. And in an election this close, you know, it could absolutely matter. But Esper is the kind of guy who I think is an avatar for, you know, he lives in Washington, D.C., has a college degree. You know, he's a professional. He's a government professional, white collar professional. I mean, he looks and sounds like a lot of these people who are not going to wind up voting for Trump. A lot of them voted for Nikki Haley in the primary. My guess is a lot of them didn't vote for Trump last time around. And so, you know, can Trump really get these folks back? I don't know. I find it unlikely. It strikes me that it's more likely that Trump could get this, you know, working class group, people who are more infrequent voters. And on that front, let me just read you. There was a tons of national polls that came out this week, by the way, including one from Marquette, I think they had them tied at 50 to 50. But there was a question in there. They broke it down by people who were registered and certain to vote, registered and not certain, not registered. Registered and certain, Biden led 52-48. Registered but not certain to vote, Trump led 56-44. Not registered at all, Trump led 64-36. Now, this is fascinating. It tells you a couple things. Number one, this is why Democrats are winning special elections, because most of the most frequent voters, the every-time voter, have gravitated to the Democrats. But number two, it's turned the old paradigm on its head of who benefits from higher turnout and who benefits from, hey, everybody votes. We used to think of that as being a Democratic thought process. But now it's pretty obvious it's a Republican thought process. Trump will do better if turnout is higher and he can get some of these low propensity or no propensity voters to actually get in the game here, because they obviously like him far more than they like Joe Biden.
So 64-36 among the not registered to vote who favored Donald Trump. Okay, those people don't matter. Those people are...
They would matter if you registered them.
Well, that's my point. I mean, if they show up, unless there's... I guess the question is, are they going to do, to your point before, about what party supports, like, same-day registration? You know, those are the kind of folks then who might, you know, in a groundswell show up and figure out what's going on. But obviously... There's a reason why you said low propensity versus high propensity. You'd rather be in the high propensity group, right?
Well, yes. I mean, high propensity are the best voters to have because you can count on them. You don't have to spend as much money to turn them out. But I'm just saying, as a Trump campaign strategy, that registered, you know, mid to low propensity voter, that's who they have to get to turn out. So what I'm saying is, we used to think, you know, the old conventional wisdom was, oh, high turnout, let's just drive around and get people to vote. Hop on the bus. That was a Democratic idea. You know, that was an idea that Democrats would use. Now, it's really upside down. And so it's just another interesting indication of how the two parties have dramatically changed in the last 10 years.
I've been saying such chatter back and forth about, a lot of election experts from the past saying, yeah, don't believe the polls. In other words, it's the fundamental, and maybe it's because of numbers like this, because they're saying the people who are going to definitely vote are going to definitely vote for Joe Biden.
Well, it was 52-48, still pretty close. I mean, Trump's getting his share of those, but where he's going to win the election are on the low to no propensity. That's where he's going to win. If he doesn't win, it'll be because they didn't get the turnout among those groups. It seemed pretty clear to me.
And my question was, and I was trying to do a little quick research here, and I forgot where it was, and that is, what is the percentage of people who don't vote for anyone? I guess most people who show up still might just scratch in a random name or a third party person at that point. That might explain, I guess, to a certain extent, the 12.5% that RFK Jr. is polling at right now nationally, is that people like me who can't stomach voting for Trump or Biden are just looking for someone else. Now, I made a mistake in the Trump Clinton race by voting for the guy's name again?
You voted for McMuffin.
I did. I voted for Evan McMullen. In that way, because at that time,
I would never have voted for McMuffin. I would have voted for McGriddle, but I would not have voted for McMuffin. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Voted for the Hamburglar. I forget who I wrote in last time. I think I wrote somebody in, but I couldn't vote for either of them again. So I just don't know how many people are like me who just basically throw their vote away. I don't know if that's scientifically, am I a party of one?
Well, if you lived in a swing state, you wouldn't be throwing your vote away. I mean, if you didn't vote for either, you'd be depriving them of your vote there. So, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of people. There's a lot of double haters. I mean, maybe 20-30% of the electorate, double haters. And where they go is a big deal. You know, you mentioned RFK. He's been on a bit of a media tour over the last few days, including a stop by Aaron Burnett's show on CNN. Jared, let's hear from RFK Jr.
Oh. What do you say to Democrats who point to Jill Stein and say, that's going to be you?
Well, right now, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do, who I pull more from in November. Right now, I'm pulling pretty much equally, probably a little more from President Trump. Like I, you know, as you pointed out, I want to pull from both of them. But, you know, do you want to, like, kind of a glib answer or a thoughtful answer?
I'd always prefer thoughtful.
Okay. I mean, what I would say is you have both sides using scare tactics. Republicans say that if Joe Biden gets in, it's going to be the end of the Republic. Democrats say if Donald Trump gets in, it's going to be the end of democracy. And I don't think either of them are actually going to destroy democracy. We have institutions in this country that are pretty enduring. And if you look at both those candidates, they're very different in their temperament. They're very different in their ideology and in their rhetoric. But on the issues where they actually depart from each other, it's a very narrow band of issues. And it's the culture war issues like abortion, guns, the border. And they're all important issues, but they're not existential issues. On the existential issues, neither of them has the capacity to address them. The biggest one being the debt. We now have $34 trillion in debt. The service on that debt is more than our military spending. So, and within 5 years, 50 cents out of every dollar collected in taxes are going to go to servicing the debt. And who ran up that debt? It was President Trump and President Biden together in just 4 years each. They ran up more spending than all the previous presidents going back to George Washington combined.
So I will just say that with that message, you know, I think he'll get some votes. Now, he's a kook. His ideology is kookiness. And, you know, I mean, he's a literal kook. And his running mate appears to me to be a kook as well. By the way, nothing says the American dream ticket like being born a Kennedy and having married and divorced a tech billionaire. American dream, you know, up from your bootstraps, just working class folks trying to make a difference. I mean, come on. But I will say, if he could be disciplined and stay on a message like what he portrayed to Aaron Burnett, you know, he'll get some votes. And I mean, there'll be Democrats who love the name. There'll be disaffected people like you who hate them both and just cast a protest vote. So, you know, he could get some votes. By the way, on this topic, the other group that was recruiting a presidential candidate, No Labels, they've announced today that they have no candidate, so they have no ticket. So right now, the people you will see on the ballot are likely to be Trump and Biden, RFK, Jill Stein, and Cornel West, pending ballot access. But it sounds like RFK's—they're steaming ahead on ballot access in most places.
If you are a fan of RFK Jr., you might visualize him the way he's being treated right now by the Democratic Party as sort of like Jefferson Smith and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the Jimmy Stewart character. And when he begins to actually have some traction in D.C. and the James Taylor machine, it literally runs children off the road, you know, and what's going on there. And so now you have situations where the Democratic Party, they are very, very concerned.
Yes.
About the effect of RFK Jr. They are showing up to campaign events. They have those mobile billboards that they're bringing around. They're trolling, and they're doing cyber attacks on his website to try to, you know, slow that down and to try to send people the wrong way. It is a, you know, I'm just saying, as I often look as a former political reporter, is it, you know, what is the other side doing to indicate how concerned they are? And by looking at what they're doing right now, I think it's a total freak out.
Oh, they're in total freak out's the right word. You see people raging about him on television. They're in court trying to keep him off the ballot. I mean, they're, you know, the defenders of democracy are trying to keep a candidate off the ballot. And so, yeah, they're worried about him. I think he slightly hurts Biden worse. I do think he probably pulls maybe a little from Trump. I don't know. You look at the polling, it feels like he hurts Biden a little worse. You know, we're a long ways to go. And by the way, you know, he's at 11 to 15% right now. By election day, will he be that high? I don't know. I mean, some of it will depend on whether they spend money and what kind of attention he gets and whether he can stay on a message. I mean, again, I'll just go back to this. He's a kook. His ideology is kookiness. And usually kooks cannot stay away from the kookiness that long. And so I suspect he won't be able to either. But, you know, what will be fascinating is when we get to the debate season, you know, are they going to let this guy operate on the debates or not? And we'll have to, I guess we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
We talked about Nicole Shanahan is a running mate in last week's podcast. And it was her idea, as you pointed out, and she funded the Super Bowl ad that was all leaning on the Kennedy name from, and the campaign ads from I think JFK back in the day in the 1960s. If you were, I'll tell you what I would do. I mean, if I were the campaign consultant, and you tell me if I'm right, Scott, I would do as few interviews as possible as far as RFK. And I would just lean completely into the Kennedy nostalgia for the Democratic and try to pull as many of those votes away as possible.
I mean, I think you have to do something because, you know, you're not going to have as much money as the other two parties. You have to drive awareness. You know, you have to remind people that you are actually running. And the kinds of people he's going to get probably need to be reminded. You know, they need to have some awareness. So he's got to strike the right balance. I mean, you know, even in his media tour last week, you know, he told Aaron Burnett that Joe Biden was a bigger threat to democracy than Trump. Then he went on Chris Cuomo's show on News Nation and said, well, that's not what I meant. You know, so, you know, he has trouble with consistency. I mean, he is, I'm just telling you, he's a kook. And so to your point, the more he does, the more likely he winds up trapped in circular talk and you know, the kinds of comments that make you go, you know? And so it's a balance for them. It's a balance.
Wanted to ask you too about reminiscent of the Clint Eastwood appearance at the Republican National Convention.
Don't how many remind years ago? Me, by the way. Please don't remind me of okay. that. Having working for Mitt Romney, being on the floor of the RNC when that happened, it still makes me want to vomit when people bring it up. But go ahead.
Oh, actually, since you brought up your reaction, what was the reaction that night?
I mean, a lot of head scratching, weird, bizarre, just. You know, we did that in prime time rather than like anything else. You know, Chris, that, you know, there was a earlier that day, I think there was this brilliant movie about Mitt Romney, the man that we played that was not in prime time. They could have played a movie. I mean, we could have had, you know, juggling chimpanzees. That would have been better, you know, than what we did.
For those folks who might not recall what we're talking about. Yeah, that was weird. It was Clint Eastwood talking to an empty chair. Yeah. That was taking the place of Barack Obama in his mind. Yeah. Well, in Green Bay the other day, Donald Trump's talking and he placed an empty lectern on the stage and was talking about his hope to debate Joe Biden. I guess, so my two questions for you are as follows, Scott. Number one is that a good strategy? In other words, is this a talking point that you think that it's good for Trump in terms of that? And do you think there will actually be a debate after all is said and done?
I still am not convinced there will be. Certainly possible, but I'm unconvinced that we can find a way at this point. And two, yeah, I think it's a good strategy for Trump to exude confidence and exude vigor by saying, yeah, I'll go into a debate stage with this guy. Cause that's what he's running on, strength. You know, again, the narrative of this campaign is strength versus weakness. So if you're the guy who's out saying, let's debate right now. And you have the other guy, you know, wandering around stages and shaking hands with the air, being noncommittal about it, you know, it kind of drives home the narrative and the point you're trying to make.
And I guess ultimately, and this is really getting into the weeds here, in terms of who decides who debates, I don't know if the commission has any say anymore, or if it's just basically an agreement between the two campaigns, but who would be more likely to try to shut out RFK Jr. from being on that stage? If he's polling at 12%, I'd be hard pressed to keep him off the stage if I were the debate commission.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Biden, I think Biden is going to do anything he can do to make this seem like a one-on-one vote like this. That's what he needs, because if you give disaffected Democrats a third door to go out of, they just might do it. Trump's base is in far better shape than Biden's base. And so they don't want to, you know, they don't want to have RFK go on. You know, what could happen? You could get on the stage, you put all three of them up there, but Trump looks like he's with it. RFK looks like he's with it. And Biden looks like he's, you know, waiting for the tapioca. So I mean, that's what could happen. And you wouldn't want that. So I suspect Biden would not. Counter argument. You put RFK up there and it's less time for Trump to talk and less time for you to talk and, you know, less likely to make a mistake. But that strikes me as a risky bet.
Well, Scott, go Cardinals. Between now and our next podcast, there'll be a total eclipse of the sun over North America here.
But will there be a total eclipse of the heart? We don't know. Next week.
There we'll actually is a town somewhere which is, I forget the name. Next week we'll have to do a recap of this. There's a town that is playing that, and it's because the name of the town has something to do with that song too. Anyway, but it's going to be a fascinating time. I was in Hopkinsville, Kentucky last time this came around, and the path of, or in that area, in that county, and the path of totality. And it's an interesting, were you in part of the path last time?
And I remember where I was. I was at my office in Louisville working, because this holds no special significance to me. And I took note of it when it happened, and then I went back to working again. So I know a lot of people are into I think it's neat. I'm you know, as curious about the heavens as anyone else, but would I drive across the country to experience darkness during the daytime? Doubtful.
Well, I think it's a generational event.
Did it change your life? Did it change your life when you did it?
It was an experience. You believe in experiences. You believe in investing in.
If it were, let me put it this way: if it were convenient for me, or I had literally nothing else to do, or maybe I do that. But I mean, I don't know. My kids, you know, I think they're giving them the glasses or whatever to look at it. Hope they don't look right at it. You know, I'm like worried about the ocular ramifications.
On that ocular ramifications note. For Jared Crawford, who's somehow stuck in a Starbucks with ear pods that don't work, and for Scott Jennings, who sounds awfully good, and for me, Joe Arnold, I hope you have a wonderful week. Be careful. If you go to the eclipse, only wear the approved glasses so we don't have any ocular ramifications. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for listening to Flyover Country with Scott Jennings.
Flyover Country with Scott Jennings is a production of Bluegrass Media Lab, coming to you from the heart of Middle America, Louisville, Kentucky. If you like what you heard, subscribe to Flyover Country on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.